Welcome to Britain. Just the routine immigration check. Can I see your passport, please, miss?
Passport? You mean you don't recognize me? I'm Madonna.
Madonna?
Yeah. Madonna.
Sorry, you lost me. You say your name is Madonna?
Yeah.
Madonna what? Or is Madonna your surname?
It's one name, okay? Madonna.
Oh, I see. It's a nickname.
Look, I'm wearing a Japanese kimono with a conical bra on the outside. Doesn't that tell you something?
You're a Japanese person who got dressed in a hurry?
Can we speed it up? I've got a very busy schedule.
All right, miss. Now then, what is the purpose of your visit?
I'm performing at Wembley Stadium.
Oh, I see. You're competing in the Horse of the Year show.
Jeez, I'm a world superstar. Who is this friggin' asshole?
So what do you think you're doing? Don't you recognize this person, man? Why, she's an international singing star, a household name.
You see, Buster?
I'm sorry, sir.
I should think so too, Johnson. I sincerely regret this incident, and please accept our deepest apologies, Miss Minogue.
Fun, wasn't it?
Look at her go. She's living.
Whoa, yeah, look, her luggage is still on the carousel. Let's bang it on flight 451 to Vladivostok.
It's time for the Million Pound Radio Show, and here are your hosts, Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel.
Thank you, good evening. Thank you and welcome to the show, but first some late headlines. John Major found himself at the centre of another health controversy today after he visited an NHS hospital, talked to some sick children and put five of them into a coma. Nick, your...
Sorry, I'm a bit distracted. It's just that Muriel and I had this dreadful row last night.
Yeah?
Really, oh, yeah, yeah. She just, you know, kept going on about how immature I was, you know. Mm. Well, I refused to get involved, you know. I just went upstairs and played with my scalextrics.
Well, I expect that took the heat out of the situation, did it?
Well, not quite. No, she just kept shouting at me. God, she was mad.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it'll all blow over. You know?
Yeah, yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Well, later we'll
what
be...
What does putrescent mean?
Putrescent? Well, it means sort of rotting, smelly. Why?
Oh, no reason, no reason.
Well, later we'll be...
And troglodyte?
Well, a troglodyte is a sort of primitive savage who lives in a cave.
Uh-huh.
Mm. Well, later we'll be...
Evisceration?
At... Well, evisceration is when your vital organs are ripped out, and this really was quite a bad row, wasn't it?
I'm telling you, I've never seen her so angry. Yeah. I'm dreading going back home tonight in case, you know, we have another one just like it.
No, don't worry, mate. It'll all blow over. You'll go home and it'll all be forgotten.
Yeah, yeah. You're right. Nothing to worry about.
That's right, yeah. Mind you.
What?
No, nothing. No.
Come on, what?
Well, it's just I was reading the statistics on domestic murders last week, you know. Terrifying. Hundreds of them every year, you know. Couples having a normal enough Barney... And the next second, wallop, one of them's in the mortuary and the other one's on the front page of the News of the World, you know.
Now, look, you're not deliberately winding me up about this, are you? By that time, you convinced me that the hole in the ozone layer was directly above my street in Islington.
But that was just a joke.
I sold my flat, Andy, for 30 quid. You're winding me
up. Nick, it's all in your mind, Nick. I was only remarking on the incidence of murders in the home, and I certainly wasn't suggesting that next time you have a row with Muriel, you'll end up with a name tag on your toe, honestly.
You should hope not. Look, Muriel is a balanced, sane person who would never just lose control and spontaneously murder me. It's unthinkable.
Right.
She'd plan it meticulously. Down to the very last detail.
Nick.
Can I stay with you tonight, Andy? No, that's exactly what you'd expect me to do.
Yeah, well, while Nick descends into total paranoia, we'd like to look at the highly emotive issue of the Pitbull Terrier. Now, with me now, I have Jane Holyrood of the Pitbull Terrier Owners Association. Now, Jane, you've brought along your own Pitbull Terrier here, Winston. Now, Do you think that dogs like Winston should be banned?
No, no, it's all hysteria. Mm. There's no reason to ban these dogs, and the people I stop and talk to in the streets agree with me.
Isn't that probably because you've got a pit bull terrier with you? I mean...
No. People are not nearly as frightened of these dogs as the media makes out. Mm-hmm. And basically, they realise the pit bull is just a dog.
Right.
And like any dog, will only attack if it's startled.
I see. And what sort of things might startle it?
Oh, people walking past, children singing, watches ticking, kneecaps, that sort of thing.
Yes, I see. Now, it's been mooted that perhaps muzzling these dogs would reduce the number of attacks.
That is completely the wrong way to approach this problem. Muzzling the dog isn't the answer. We should concentrate on the owners.
Oh, well, I agree there. Muzzling the owners is something I've always advocated. Sadly, that idea is fraught with legal problems, apparently. Now, the government, of course, is proposing many new laws to curb these dogs so that...
Sorry, but these proposed new laws just won't work.
Well, why won't they work?
Because the government is labouring under the misapprehension the law of the land applies to dog owners.
Oh, right.
Patently absurd. Dog owners, as we all know, are exempt on account of the fact that in British law, the rights of a dog outweigh those of a human being.
Well, is that true?
Well, do you have the right to empty your bowels on your neighbour's lawn? Are you free to leap out and frighten cyclists? Would you be allowed to copulate in the street on a first date?
Well, no, I'd be locked up.
I rest my case. See, Andy, the fact is it's a lot of media hype. The pit bull terrier is just a dog.
Mm.
That's all, just a dog.
Mm. Is he okay?
I think he's a bit bothered by your cat.
Oh, is Tiddles coming? Oh, hello, Tiddles. Oh, you come looking for some milk, yeah? Yeah, I bring him in because I don't like to leave him alone in the house, you know?
He's big, isn't he?
Oh, he's not that big as panthers go, actually. No. He's quite petite, you know? Who's daddy's little Tiddles then?
Panther?
Well, he's just a cat. That's all, you know. He may be huge and powerful and strong enough to swallow a pit bull terrier, but... he's still a cat.
You're a psycho.
He's only a cat.
Fancy keeping a panther.
Do you want to stroke him?
You're a nutter. I mean, don't come near me. Really, that's just sick.
Oh, nice one, Andy. Look at that go.
Yeah. It was worth hiring a panther for the day, yeah. It's good to see London Zoo spotting the commercial potential of their larger panther. He likes you, Nick.
Yeah. Can you ask him to put me down now?
Tiddles, put that little cock. Can't they climb well, Nick? Yeah. Hey, are you all right up there? Don't startle him.
No, all right. I'll just lie here quietly in his mouth.
Yeah. Well, look, we better take a break here, listeners, and hand you back to Radio 4.
Andy, he's got a recipe book out. Yeah, well, right. Floyd on comedians.
Well, we'll try to return to the £1 million radio show later, but meanwhile, here's Desert Island Discs with Sue Lawley.
This week, my guest on Desert Island Discs is the man who has won the Nobel Prize for Mathematics and wrote the best-selling book, The Sanctity of Logic. He is, of course, Professor Peter Wells. Professor, do you think you would flourish on our desert island?
Well, hopefully my training in logic would help me to survive.
And which would be the first record that you would take to your island?
Well, of course, that would rather depend on my circumstances. If I had been on board a ship, I might possibly have had time to select a few of the lightest records and hurl them aboard the lifeboat. But on the other hand, had I, say, been forced to parachute from a stricken aircraft, I wouldn't have had time to choose any at all. Of course, both scenarios presuppose that I would have had my entire record collection to hand. A circumstance which, frankly, I think is statistically highly improbable.
Right. Well, let's say that you were on board a ship which sank, but you had your record collection with you and you had time to choose some favourites. Which would be the first record you would take?
Well, then, I suppose I would have to say Mozart's Requiem.
So, to find solace in the solitude of the desert island, you'd listen to your recording of Mozart's Requiem.
No.
Sorry?
Well, how would I listen to it? I wouldn't have a record player.
Well, just assume there's a record player.
On a desert island?
Yes.
Hmm. And this record player, did I salvage it from the wreck, or was it a pre-existing record player?
Look, I think we're getting a little bogged down here, Professor. It's all supposed to be pretend. There is no actual desert island.
Oh, I see. The whole situation is a hypothetical one.
Yes.
I'm an imaginary castaway.
That's right.
On a non-existent theoretical island.
Yes.
With a real record player. I'm sorry, but that's a logical impossibility. An abstract location with a working stereo. It's not a concept I can...
No, no, no. The record player is pretend as well. The whole program is an exercise in just pretending. So if you could just put logic to one side for one moment...
I'm so sorry. Force of habit.
So, when you played your copy of Mozart's Requiem on your record player, what thoughts would come to your mind as you sat on the desert island?
Well, Sue, as I sat there on the desert island listening to the intensely moving cadences of Mozart's masterpiece cascading through the moist tropical air, I know I would be thinking, where's the electricity for this record player coming from?
Well, I'm afraid we've had to leave Desert Island Is for a moment, for technical reasons. Later, on Talking Point, should our children study more Shakespeare at school, especially if it will get Prince Charles to shut up? So let's listen instead to Actuality, the fly-on-the-wall programme which this week visits the location of a feature film.
I've just got to talk to the actors now.
Okay,
Jeffrey, Greta, this is the bed scene that is central to the whole movie.
Right, yes.
They're alone together in the hotel room, and they just start to rip each other's clothes off, two wounded souls losing themselves in the oblivion of the sexual act. So I want it to be lustful.
Oh, lustful, right.
Animalistic, and above all, realistic, okay?
Okay, Tristram, yeah.
Okay, then, quiet on the set, please. Mark it.
Scene 29, take one.
Action. Hang on a tick. I can never get these things open.
Jeff, what are you doing?
I'm opening this box of condoms. What does it look like?
Why?
Well, because we're shooting a realistic sex scene. And, you know.
Yes, but I think it spoils the atmosphere of the scene somewhat if one moment you're kissing Greta's glistening breast and the next you're fumbling around with a packet of mates.
Yeah, you are. You're so right, of course. Stupid of me. I'll have one ready. That'd be...
What I'm saying is no condom at all.
Right, I see. So these two people who've just met check into a hotel room and lose themselves in the oblivion of the sexual act.
That's it?
Without any thought about the health implications. I mean, God, you know, I mean, God knows what diseases they might give each other. I'm sorry, Tristram, but I just don't think my character would do that.
Oh, for God's sake! No sizzling sex scene has ever included a sequence with a condom packet, and we're not starting now. It's not erotic.
Well, we could make it erotic.
Yes, I could sort of grunt as I open the packet, you know.
I could moan, right?
No!
Well, look, why not edit around the packet business?
Yes.
You know, one second Jeff's got a lustful gleam in his eye, and the next shot a condom's magicked onto the end of his, you know.
No! I am the director, and I'm saying no condoms.
Really?
I told them it was a mistake casting you, Jeffrey. You're the only actor I know who insists on rewriting car chases so that no one breaks the speed limit. Mm.
I just think we have a responsibility to the public. You know what I mean?
Now, are you going to do this scene without condoms or not?
Well, personally, Tristram, I feel you're infringing on our right to interpret our characters.
Yeah, me too. But, we're professionals, love, and you're the director. If you say no condoms, then... so be it.
At last. Right. Can we go again for the top, then, please?
Scene 29, take two. And action.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. Oh, darling. I want to know everything about you. Your hopes, your dreams, your medical history.
Mr. Jeff.
Well, it works for me. I don't know about you.
Next week, Actuality reports on the progress of Spaceship Voyager, which is charting the distant margins of the galaxy, and which scientists hope may one day find the planet that Brian Clough is from. But now I think we can return you to Desert Island Discs.
But, Professor...
Look, logically, if the island is uninhabited, it cannot possibly be connected to any mains electricity supply. So unless some previous visitors left a generator
yes,
or...
there is a generator.
A generator. But how on earth...
There just is, okay?
So you're saying I should accept the generator as a given, like the record player?
Yes.
That makes two assumptions completely unsupported by objective evidence. As a scientist, I'm not sure I can accept that.
Look, I'll tell you what, right? Forget the island, just tell us your 8 favourite records, and then piss off.
Well, we've had to leave Desert Island Discs due to electrical storms interfering with the radio signal. But I understand we can return you to the Million Pound Radio Show.
And welcome back, listeners. So, Nick, oi, what are you doing? Nick, what are you doing?
Just practising my ninja bus stop technique.
Ninja bus stop technique?
Yeah, you obviously don't travel by bus.
Not often, no.
Oh, it's not easy these days, you see. People don't queue anymore. Mm-hmm. They just sort of lurk. In packs near the bus stop. And then when the bus comes, they just stampede. You see pictures of sharks homing in on blood.
Yeah.
It's worse. So anyway, what I normally do is wait on top of the bus shelter, you see. See, that way you can drop down on top of the pack and normally take out 6 or 7 pensioners before they've even seen you. You know, especially if you come at them out of the sun. Hi-ya!
Take out 6 or 7 pensioners.
Yeah, I know, it sounds callous, doesn't it? But don't be fooled by pensioners, Andy. Don't be fooled by pensioners, they're ruthless. Think about it for a second. Think how tough you have to be to live in London and reach pensioner age.
Oh, yeah.
I tell you, I've seen a 90-year-old woman send 3 mountain bikers splatting into a lamppost with just one judicious flick of a shopping trolley.
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, I prefer to go by tube, you know. It's more relaxing.
The tube? Relaxing?
Yeah, it's really nice at Earl's Court, you know, standing on the platform, watching those little mice running around on the track.
I see, I hate mice.
Oh, but the ones at Earl's Court are lovely, you know. They're lovely little things, you know. You see them scuttling around, looking for food, building their nests on the rails, you know.
They build their nest on the rails? Mm. What if a train comes along?
Well, the babies will be grown up by then, won't they? This is the district line we're talking about.
That's stupid of me.
Yeah, yeah. Some legal news now. Following several protracted court cases, which have cost a lot of public money, the Lawlaws have decided that in cases where the jury cannot agree, it'll be decided by a penalty shootout. Sounds a lot more reliable than the present system, yeah. Anyway. They've got some more late news. Following complaints about uncollected refuse, Wandsworth Council have announced that they will now pay the rats to dispose of it. And thus formalise what's hitherto been an informal arrangement.
Now it's time for Andy's Probe.
This week I'm at an international arms fair in Dubai, probing the arms trade. Now, this is where the latest state-of-the-art weaponry is up for sale.
Want to throw the latest in hand grenades, mate? 3 for 10 pence. Blow the head off the wooden dissident and you win a goldfish.
No. thank you all the same, but now, at this arms fair, all the world's leading arms manufacturers are displaying their very latest products to prospective buyers, like General Emilio Estevez here, commander in the Panamanian Army. Now, Commander Estevez, what sort of weapons are you looking to buy here?
Mostly lethal gases.
Right. And exactly what would you use these lethal gases for?
We will use the gases to combat the mice.
I mean, like, there's no way you'd use these gases against political opponents or anything.
No, my friend, no. We need to get rid of our mice. Subversive rodents that want to overthrow us. And must be crushed with an iron fist! Mice that must be annihilated. Exterminated.
terminated.
Right, so calling in the council isn't an option then.
Pardon?
Well, it doesn't matter. Well, I'll leave you to fondle that garrote, OK, for a bit. But, because over here, I see a familiar face, and it's Commander-in-Chief during the Gulf War, General Norman Schwarzkopf. General, what are you doing here? Are you buying weapons?
Hell no, Andy. I'm just dropping off some jumble, you know. old weapons we no longer use, so we thought, what the heck, some needy country might as well get the benefit.
Now, of course, the Gulf War was a great shop window for American arms, especially the so-called clever weapons, like this Patriot anti-missile system here.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Patriot is a very clever weapon. So clever, in fact, that in the right atmospheric conditions, it can launch itself. Look at that baby go.
Right, so that was electromagnetic interference that made it fire.
Yeah, I reckon somewhere someone must be cooking with a microwave or something. Of course, the missile has no incoming target to fix onto, so it'll seek out and destroy the nearest source of heat. See that guy doing the keep fit exercises? Yeah, I thought it'd be him.
General, were you surprised at the success of these weapons during the war?
Well, I tell you, Andy, I was amazed at what could be achieved by these things. They truly were intelligent missiles. In fact, one of them was so intelligent, it disarmed itself, flew to Switzerland, and became a commodities broker. Similarly, we had one smart bomb which was specifically programmed to take out Saddam Hussein, which it did. It took him out to the movies and then to an Indian meal. But obviously, we learned from all this.
Well, what did you learn?
We learned not to have bombs that are smarter than we are.
All right.
Now, you must excuse me, Andy. I have to go and plug my video, The Best of Storm and Norman, including my 10 most evasive press briefings and exclusive footage of my barber shaving my head with a wood plane.
All right. thanks for your time, General. Now, moving across towards
cluster
this...
Cluster bombs, nice bunch of cluster bombs. Cause a fluster with a juicy cluster.
Yeah, no, thank you. thank you, but no, I'm not buying. Now, over here is the stand of the British arms manufacturer, Kitchener, Haig, Montgomery, PLC, and Nigel Bethel. You are head of sales. How's business been going?
Oh, very well, Andy. We've had a very successful morning. We sold a low-yield nuclear missile system to President Assad of Syria.
I see. Now, presumably, you check with him thoroughly exactly what he wants the missile system for.
Oh, of course we check. Mm. Yes. We're not immoral.
Right.
He wants it to suppress mice.
Well, it's good to see the industries tightening up, you know, after the lessons of the Gulf. Now, moving across here, past the queue at the stand selling live mice, I come to what for me is the most interesting stand, which belongs to another British manufacturer, Ecobomb Limited. Now, Dave Watts, marketing manager, what exactly... Oh, I'm sorry, that's my watch alarm. There you go, three more Patriots. Now, Dave... Sorry, watch alarm went on. I'm sorry, mate. Now, Dave... Describe this new product of yours.
Well, Andy, as you know, the problem with most bombs is that they invariably contain high amounts of explosive, and these do tend to hurt people physically.
Yeah.
Now, our bombs don't do that.
Really?
No. You see, if we take this bomb here, mm-hmm. right, it's programmed to seek out an individual target like a Saddam or a Gaddafi, right? And using its computer system, it will sneak beneath the radar, find the target at, say, a public meeting, penetrate the building, home in on the victim, and hover above his head, shouting, "Wanker! Wanker! Wanker!" in any accent you like. Mm. Now, research shows that to despots unaccustomed to mickey-taking, the effects of this are quite devastating.
So this is a psychological bomb. It destroys through humiliation.
That's right. We also have a stealth missile, which can home in on the target undetected and slide a whoopee cushion under his seat. And perhaps most awesomely destructive of all, a computerized bomb that saturates an area of 40 miles radius with high-intensity photos of the victim's penis just after he's been in a cold sea. Mm.
That's really fighting dirty, though, isn't it?
War is dirty, Andy.
Oh, my God, there go another five Patriots.
Don't worry, Andy, they just decided to have a race.
Oh, right. Now, finally, I'm going to try on one of these amazing computerized helmets that US pilots used during the war. Now, if I put it on there... Now, a computer is presenting a display on my visor, and now the missile will home in on whatever I am looking at. So, if I look at the designated target and fire the missile... Now, as long as I keep looking at the target, the missile will...
Excuse me, pal, want to buy some napalm?
I'm sorry, what did you say? Well, obviously, the system isn't designed to cope with some Geordie idiot tapping you on the shoulder. But it's fascinating technology, and much of it British. Well, next week I'll be probing the world of boxing and asking, does being pummeled incessantly on the head carry health implications? So now it's back to Nick in the studio.
Hey, Andy, yeah? You know those five patriots that took off a moment back?
Yeah.
Well, they're still hunting for a heat-emanating target, and, you know that visor you're wearing? Blimey, Andy, five missiles up your ass. What did you do?
World record for 200 metres. Wind-assisted.
Well, that's all for tonight, except to say we've just heard the government have reversed their decision to kill all pit bulls in the country when someone points out that it might possibly happen one day that a pit bull might attack Giles Brandreth.
Live in hope. And... And now some rather sad sports news. A specialist has confirmed that Paul Gascoigne's latest injury seriously threatens his future career. Apparently, exploratory surgery has revealed that Gazza has severely torn all the ligaments in his tongue. Good night.
Good night.
The Million Pound Radio Show was written and presented by Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel, with Felicity Montague and Jasper Jacob. It was produced by Paul Mayhew Archer.
Now, let's see.
Look, Sunbeam. Thousands of very famous people have been guests on this programme, and not one of them has ever quibbled about the record player and how it's plugged in.
And I'm supposed to accept that as a rational position, am I? No one else said anything.
Shut up, you whinging little buffin!
Oh, I see. If you can't win an argument by reason, you resort to abuse.
Wrong. I resort to violence.
That edition of Desert Island Discs was broadcast as a tribute to the late Professor Peter Wells, who tragically died during the making of that programme. Next week, instead of the advertised edition of Desert Island Discs, Sue Lawley will be presenting Down Your Way from Holloway Prison.